Debt issuance by the European Commission on behalf of the European Union has increased massively since 2020. Of the approximately 400 billion euros in outstanding EU debt in May of this year, 85% was issued since 2020. Large-scale borrowing is expected to continue until 2026 to fund the remainder of the Next Generation EU and concessional loans to support Ukraine. When these programs were launched, interest rates were at historic levels, even negative for maturities below 10 years. This is very different now, with interest rates turning positive since September of 2022 and increasingly very sharply. This means that the cost of borrowing for all countries and the EU is increasing. And on top of that, the EU as a borrowing identity has also faced a widening of the spreads between its yields and those of major European issuers, including France and Germany. Why is that, and what are the implications? In a recent paper, my colleagues have attempted to answer exactly this question. Welcome to The Sound of Economics, Bruegel's podcast series. I'm Maria Demeritis, and I'm joined today by two of the authors of this paper, Gregory Clay.
Hello, Maria.
Hi. And Conor McCaffrey. Hi, Conor. Good to have you.
Hi, Maria. Good to be here.
Conor, let's start with you and tell us a little bit about the evolution of EU debt, but also tell us what is EU debt and why is the difference, say, to debt issued by Portugal or by any other country?
Yeah, I think that's probably a pretty good place to start to make sure we're on the same page. So when we talk about EU debt in this paper and in general, we mean debt issued by the European Commission on behalf of the EU as a whole. So it's not some sort of an aggregation of member state borrowing or whatever. It's a distinct kind of entity. So this has happened for decades. The European Commission has been active on international bond markets for a long time, but it's been on quite a small scale. So this would have historically been, you know, to fund projects like the MFA programs for non-EU countries, such as Ukraine, for EFSM lending programs to Eurozone countries in distress, for example, Ireland and Portugal, and also then for what's called balance of payments programs, so to non-Euro EU countries such as Latvia, Romania, Hungary. However, these loans were always issued on what's known as a back-to-back basis, which means that while the borrowing was done by the European Commission, the loans themselves were dispersed to the countries who therefore bore the cost of this borrowing themselves. Okay. So while these loans were guaranteed by the European budget, the actual costs of repaying them and of servicing this debt went to the countries themselves. So if we kind of look at about 2019, this was the kind of the state of the European Commission if you think of it as a debt management office. It was a pretty small scale borrower. It borrowed when it needed to for these countries, but it didn't have a large presence on the market. Things changed, as lots of things changed in 2020. But from this perspective, it kind of changed with the launch of two programs, which we may or may not be familiar with. So SURE, which was designed to support short-term work placements, short-term unemployment support schemes during COVID, and then more importantly again, Next Gen EU. So SURE involved basically about 98 billion euro of back-to-back loans to countries between 2020 and the end of 2022. So disbursements have now finished for that. How SURE changed things was that it really massively increased the scale of EU borrowing. But because, again, it was back-to-back, it didn't hugely change the nature of EU borrowing. So again, if the EU borrowed to support short-term work programs in Spain, the cost of that borrowing went to Spain. The real kind of watershed moment was Next Gen EU. So this is when the EU and its famous Hamiltonian moment, which we may discuss more.
Debatable.
Exactly. It basically agreed for joint borrowing. So of the kind of, there's three different avenues that NGEU went to support. There was grants to countries, to the Recovery and Resilience Facility. There was loans to countries, so countries could claim loans. So Italy has claimed loans, Greece has claimed loans, but not many countries have. And then also there's additional kind of top-up support for pre-existing EU programs, such as InvestEU, ReactEU, Horizon. So the real kind of change here has been that now, for the first time ever, the EU budget will finance some of these loans. This is kind of what is technically known as the non-repayable elements of NGEU. So that's the grants to countries and the support for these programs that we've mentioned. This should, by the end of 2026, amount to about 421 billion euro. Yeah. So now, for the first time, this is going to have to be financed by the EU budget.
Oh, Okay. So we have both huge amount of monies that are now being borrowed by the EU, previously not the case, and we also have that some of it is grants, so it's not, so the cost borne is not by the countries themselves, but it is by something else. And we need to discuss what that something else is, right? The EU budget, but, you know, what is that? So, Gregory, if I may come to you, and now in the paper, in the new, very interesting paper you guys have written, you talk about, well, the EU and the fact that, you know, we need to pay interest on this, on this debt, and interest rates are rising. Now, what's the story here?
So, yeah, we tried really to do two things in the paper. The first thing is, why are interest rising on EU debt? That's an important question that everybody is asking about. And the second thing that we do in the paper is also to estimate what will be the impact of this on the EU budget, because as Connor just said, part of it will be borne by the EU budget. Mm-hmm. So we need to understand that, given the large magnitude of EU debt, we need to understand how much it will cost us.
So inflation is rapidly increasing for the past more than a year now, 18 months or so. We have interest rates responding to that. And of course, that means that now the cost of borrowing for all countries and the EU is increasing. And you know, I think we need to understand why this is. But also, what's an interesting thing you have in the paper is that the diversion of interest rates, namely the spreads, how much countries have to pay between them, is actually increasing. And so is for the EU, right?
Exactly. I think the first thing that we explain in the paper is the fact that, yeah, EU interest rates have been increasing, but all rates have been increasing. All euro-denominated rates have been increasing. And the reason behind that, the major reason behind that is very simple. It's because the ECB has been increasing its policy rates. Why is that? Because we know that inflation has been really high and above the ECB target. Mm-hmm. So the ECB needed to increase rates. And so when the ECB increased rates, all euro-denominated rates increase at the same time. It's the case for all sovereigns, and therefore the EU is no exception. Yeah. And the EU actually will have to learn to live with that, because it's something very new for the EU that its rates are correlated with the movement of interest rate, because this is the first time that they finance grants with debt.
But what I think is interesting is that this, as you said, this increase in the interest rates, it happens for all countries, and yes, of course, but this increase in the interest, it doesn't affect all countries the same way, right? Some countries actually bear a greater burden, as it were. So it's as almost it hurts them more while the interest rates are coming up.
And this is exactly what happened with the EU. And actually, it's the most interesting part, the fact that all rates have been increasing. Okay, we all know that. What's more interesting about EU debt is that the spreads, or the difference between, let's say, the German yields and the EU debt has been increasing. And for instance, even though at the beginning of the program, so in 2021, when the program, when SURE was launched, and then when NGU was launched, the EU was paying an interest rate that was between the one of Germany and the one of France, which made sense because the EU has actually a better rating than France. The EU is rated AAA by most rating agencies, while France is only rated AA, let's say. So it was normal for the EU to pay less than France. However, this has changed.
So it's as though you're saying that when EU debt was issued, it was like an average, but now it's worse than an average.
Yeah, something like that.
Why is that?
That's exactly what we discuss in the paper.
Yeah. So, Connor, what is the kind of the main reasons why the EU debt rating is increasing higher than others?
Yeah, it's a very interesting and important question, Maria, and unfortunately it doesn't have one very simple, straightforward answer like we might like. So first of all, kind of to clarify, EU bonds are considered a part of SSA bonds. So that means supranational, subnational, and agency bonds. So that's kind of the category of bonds that would include stuff like the European Investment Bank, the ESM, and even banks like KfW, which is the German Development Bank. These banks, kind of for historical reasons, there's a convention that they are priced off what is known as the swap curve. So we go into more detail in the paper about this, but essentially this means that if the EIB is issuing a new 10-year bond, what the market will do is they will look at the 10-year swap rate and price the bond accordingly. Now, swaps are instruments used by financial institutions to guard against interest rate risk. As interest rates rise, we see the price of swaps go up, which means that the yields on the bonds also go up. So therefore, throughout 2022, as we saw this tightening that Gregory mentioned, the price of swaps went up, driving up the cost of borrowing for the EU. At the same time, however, we had a secondary countervailing effect, which was that demand for the bonds was extremely high. Bonds are bonds issued by Germany, and they are considered safe assets in Europe. So in times of geopolitical stress, so for example, after Russia invasion of Ukraine, we saw high demand for bonds. Secondly, demand for bonds was kept high because lots of margin calls were made around energy contracts as prices went up there. So this meant there was a real collateral scarcity, and so demand for bonds went up. This meant that the rates on German borrowing were kept lower than they probably would have had this scarcity not occurred. So taken together, we had both the price of swaps and therefore EU borrowing costs rising, and also the German borrowing costs and therefore the other sovereigns that are priced off the bonds, their borrowing costs being kept low. And these two effects together helped us see some really significant widening of these spreads. And this is seen also if we look at other SSA borrowers, for example, the EIB or KfW, we see these similar spreads.
Okay, so these account for what you called, Connor, as the circumstantial factors, right? Okay, but I think in the paper you also have other factors, right? You have institution factors, and can you take us through as what are the, or market factors? I mean, what are they?
Yeah, both of them. So market factors is that basically there are market features that the European bonds don't have compared to major issuers like Germany or France.
Is that because they're new?
Yeah, exactly. It's because they are new, there is less outstanding of them. The volume is smaller. So it means that they are less liquid because every day there are less securities that are exchanged. Actually, every day on average, there is like less than 5 billion euro of EU bonds that are exchanged. While for France, it's something like between 10 and 15. And for Germany, it's between 20 and 25. Mm-hmm. So you see, it's much, much smaller. So it means that it's more difficult to resell them if you want, because there are less transactions. While investors, they really like to be able to resell them easily. That's one of the characteristics of a safe asset. It's something you need cash, you go on the market and you can resell it immediately. That's the case for German bonds. That's the case for French bonds. And that's not yet the case for EU bonds. And it's logical because there are less of them, so there are less transactions.
So even though there's been a huge increase in issuance of EU debt, as Connor explained at the beginning, there still is a lot, much more German debt out there and French debt out there. So that actually means that the market doesn't know the product as well.
Yeah, that's the first thing. The second thing is that when you're an investor, you value the fact that you can resell it easily, but you also value the fact that you can post it as a collateral. Actually, as also Connor mentioned, bonds, sovereign bonds and SSA bonds are often used as collateral. But the German bonds or the French bonds, they benefit from small haircuts when they are used as collateral. So basically, most operation today, financial operation, you need some collateral and you deposit that collateral in a CCP, in a clearinghouse. And the clearinghouse, they have haircuts because they need to basically insure themselves in case something goes wrong. And the haircuts that they use for French bonds or German bonds is really small. While the haircuts that they use for EU bonds, it's still higher. So basically for an investor, if I want to use those bonds for collateral reasons, it's much better to own French or German bonds.
But why is the haircut bigger? Is it still because the clearinghouse don't know this debt so much, right?
I think so, because, for instance, the ECB, actually following a recommendation that we made in a previous paper, now they are going to value EU bonds in the same way as they would value a sovereign bond with the same rating. So now the haircut at the ECB, because you also use collateral in monetary operations, it's the same for EU bonds than for Germany. So that's really a great progress. Actually, this was announced in December of 2022, and this is going to be applied starting actually in a few weeks, in 29th of June. But this is not the case for CCPs. CCPs, they have their own risk methodology. They don't follow the ECB. Some of them follow them, but the big CCPs, they don't follow the ECB. And for the moment, and we have talked actually to them to ask them that, they see it differently also because there is less history of it. So they prefer to value it differently and to ask for a higher haircut.
If I'm about to boil it down to sort of the bare essentials, is basically this is new debt. So there's the markets still don't know much about it. They need to find out. And there's much less of it than by comparison to debt of other countries, right?
Yes. And actually another market feature that is quite important is that sovereign bonds are included in what are called sovereign bond indices. And actually, a lot of investors are now passive. They just replicate those indices. So as an investor yourself, you just ask, I don't know, your bank or an insurance company or whatever to replicate this kind of index. And there will be a bit of French bonds, a bit of German bonds, a bit of Italian bonds, etc. And the thing is that EU bonds are not included in those indices. And this means that this reduces the investor base because a lot of investor or portfolio managers, they use those indices as a base. So not being included in that reduce your liquidity and reduce your investor base.
Exactly. Well, this is an institutional factor, right? I mean, presumably you could change that by saying, look, from now on, I will include them in the index or not.
Yes, but those indices are privately provided. So the EU cannot force those index providers to do it. And actually, this will come to, I guess, your next question is that it's an institutional issue because those are called sovereign bond indices. Yeah. And that's where we see that EU bonds are not considered as sovereign. Yeah. And for instance, to be considered a sovereign, you need to fulfill some criteria. And I think that, for instance, not having taxing power make you not a sovereign.
Okay, but this is an important issue, and that's a good segue to the next discussion. Okay, what does this all mean? I mean, do we care that we have the EU effectively paying a little premium to issue debt by comparison to what it would have paid had it been a country?
Well, I think this kind of issue falls into that unfortunate intersection of issues that are both very important and very technical, because this has a huge implication in terms of the EU financing the borrowing costs. So as we mentioned, there's about 421 billion euro here, which will be borne by the EU budget. The cost of paying this interest rate has been accounted for in the MFF and in the annual EU budgets. However, when the Commission was forecasting this cost, it used market futures rates, it looked at historical trends, and it built in a little bit of leeway, but it still only came to the amount of about 15 billion euro over this entire period.
So can I just say, so it did this back in 2021?
Yeah, December, January 21.
Exactly. And basically, looking at these trends, it forecasted that interest rates would ultimately rise to about 1.15% by 2026, 2027, as we've seen that it might end up back down there, but it's certainly not the case now.
And that amounted to 50 billion?
15 billion over the entire course of this MFF.
Is the amount of money we have to pay as interest costs, right? Or just not understanding.
Is the amount that was budgeted for paying this, or the amount was allocated for it. However, and here we should mention our colleague Leonard Velsla, who did a lot of work on this, we actually came to the point that looking at current market rates, looking at expectations for the future, looking at expected kind of borrowing timeframes and whatnot, we came to the amount of, if rates stay around the baseline expected by the market, this would amount to about 30 billion over the same period.
So double?
Double. So basically, and again, here we get quite technical, the cost of financing this EU, they call it the EU recovery instrument, so the next-gen EU support, was included in a section of the MFF, which would basically mean that it's capped. So this entire area, there's a certain amount that is allowed to be spent on this. However, as these interest rates rise more than double than what has been allocated, this may have implications on other programs, which are also included in the same section. For example, Erasmus and the European Social Fund. So really, unfortunately, it does matter.
So if I understand you correctly, then you're saying that in order to pay for this windfall, expected a greater increase on the payments, it will have to take money from other budget lines in this in the MFF.
If nothing changes.
Yeah, because the EU budget has been constructed in that way, because generally we decide at the beginning of the budgetary cycle, at the beginning of what we call the MFF, the money that will be spent on this and that program. And actually the negotiation between countries at that time is really tough. And so they want to know how much will be spent, also how much they will get from the EU budget during the next 7 years. Mm-hmm. But so they are not used to having expenditures that can fluctuate. And interest costs are in principle, can fluctuate.
Indeed. So now you're telling us that on current interest rates and on current market expectations till 2026, we are missing half of 30 billion to pay for the interest rate. So what would there be implications for the budget?
So either, as Connor was saying, we will have to cut on other programs that are including in the same category of spending, and including important programs like Erasmus Plus and the European Social Fund Plus, which are important programs of the EU, or there are other solutions. And one of the solutions that we discuss in the paper and something that we recommend is that during the negotiations that will take place actually in a few weeks about the review of the MFF. So basically, the MFF lasts for 7 years, but in the middle, there is a review to see if we should change things. And so, yeah, no, very sensible, in particular when you have interest costs rising. So what we recommend is that they use this opportunity to take interest costs out of those this category of expenditure. Actually, it's really weird that they put it there. I don't know what was in their mind. Maybe at that time they thought that interest rate will not rise forever, which was maybe the view that we still had in 2020.
Of course, it was not unreasonable to think, having had interest rates for such a long time, it was not unreasonable to believe that this would continue.
Yeah, actually, I don't blame the Commission for making those forecasts. They used market-based forecasts, so nobody expected interest rate to rise as much.
But is that possible in the context of the budgeting procedures? Because, you know, these things can be, you know, when they are written down, it's not so easy to change lines. Can they do that? Or
it seems that they can do that. I have talked to people who say they can do that. And actually, there is a good example of a new program, of a new expenditure that is not below this so-called expenditure ceiling. It's a program that is called the Globalization Adjustment Fund. And one of the characteristics of this program that is used basically to give money to region to reskill people who have lost their job. We don't know how much region will ask over the course of the MFF. So what they do is they put it above the so-called expenditure ceiling. So what we recommend in the paper is that actually they do the same with the interest cost, that they should put it above this ceiling.
Let's keep things simple here. Okay, you can take it from one budget line and put it elsewhere, but you still need to pay 50 billion. You have to take it from something else.
Yes. So now we have been talking about expenditures, but we should also talk about revenues. And the revenues actually have been, in theory, growing because the EU debt is guaranteed by what we call EU own resources. And basically, it's the fact that countries have promised to give money to the EU, either to pay for the EU programs or to repay its debt. And if you remember, in 2020, when Next Generation EU was created, the own resource ceiling was increased. So basically, normally, countries, they allow the Commission to ask for 1.4% of GNI, which is a measure not far from GDP for people who don't know GNI. So the EU should be able to claim 1.4% of GNI. Given that we know that there was this debt, they increased that own resources ceiling to 2% of GNI.
Up to 2%.
Up to 2% of GNI to the member state. And actually, GNI has been increasing quite quickly in recent years because GNI is nominal GNI. So when there is a lot of inflation, nominal GNI increases. So the money that the EU can ask countries to pay for programs or to repay the debt has actually increased a lot. So there is a kind of inconsistency in the EU budget, is that revenues or potential revenues have been increasing a lot thanks to inflation, but expenditure on the other side, and this ceiling, and it's quite technical, but I think it's important to go into these details, are only increased with a fixed amount. So basically, everything was decided in 2018 prices. So when there was a negotiation about the MFF, everything was agreed in 2018 prices. And then everything was inflated with 2%. Yeah. So on the expenditure side, everything only grows by 2% per year, because this is the ECB target, I guess. But on the potential revenue side, the GNI is increasing very quickly because of inflation. So we don't have any problem with revenues, to be honest. Actually, a lot of people have been asking me, in particular journalists, that they fear that the EU cannot repay its debt. But actually, the guarantee for the EU debt has been increasing very quickly. So there is really no problem about that. As long as EU countries honor their debt to the EU, there is no problem. The problem comes really from these ceilings on the revenue side and this, to be honest, stupid rule that ceilings are only increasing with 2% per year, even though inflation can be 7%.
But it's not an inconsistency. Quite the contrary, actually. I think that to have the flexibility on the revenues deals with these types of shocks, right? The shocks of having to pay more money. And so you're actually quite cautious on the way that you spend, but you allow for the possibility of having the ability to raise revenues on the revenue side should you ever need it. And it serves us very well, if I understand correctly, no?
This time it served us very well, but the opposite could have happened. And actually it happened in the previous MFF, is that inflation was below 2%. So expenditure were increasing at 2% because it's fixed, while actually the guarantee, the GNI, were increasing by less than 2% because inflation was really low. So I would say that dealing with this inconsistency once and for all, I think would be very important.
Okay, exactly. But allow for the right buffers, right? Conor, anything to add on this? A very interesting conversation.
No, just to echo that, it kind of, looking from the outside, it doesn't really make sense that you include a non-discretionary type of expenditure like interest rate servicing costs in the category that's for discretionary expenditure.
Very good point.
Yeah, because I think these expenditure ceilings, they were created by member states who don't want the parliament and the commission to spend too much money. But this is neither the fault of the commission nor the fault of the parliament. It's just interest rates are increasing.
Okay, but I think on the whole, I think you have good news. I mean, I think in the sense that, yes, inflation is making interest rates go up. Interest payments on debt for everybody is going up. You've pointed out to the fact that there is a spread, actually, that the EU is maybe paying disproportionately higher rate than any other country. And that comes to a number of interesting market features that you've elaborated. And then you also say that, you know, the burden, the extra burden that we have as a result of inflation, interest rate payments, is covered by an interesting trick on the revenue side of the EU budget, which, by the way, this time round serves us well, but maybe in the other side of the cycle may not serve us quite as well, right? So at least for the moment, this great increase in the interest rate base, Conor, you called it 50 billion euros, it could go more depending on where interest rates go, yeah, is actually covered by the EU, yeah, potentially, right? Yeah. So this is not big news. It's interesting, though, to reflect on this, right? And then you're also suggesting that we should actually change that in the budget, right? And actually make it more consistent, right, Conor? Or?
I think that makes sense, yeah. And just to echo your point that the Commission do seem to be well aware of the spread. The Commission are working on it. They have their plans to introduce a repo market next year, a repo facility. There's they've moved to what's known as a unified funding strategy, which basically would increase, it's quite technical, but it would increase the liquidity of EU bonds. So the Commission is aware of this. They're working on it. But there's going to be kind of some rewiring of the financial architecture around these type of bonds required to really bring that spread back down to where it possibly should be.
Okay, wonderful. So anything else to add, Gregory?
No, something that we didn't discuss in the end was the institutional features. The fact that actually EU bonds are not yet considered as sovereign. And we think that one discussion is going to be important in the next few months. It's actually the discussion on genuine own resources, because the Commission is supposed to make some proposal about that. And I think if we have like real own resources, so if the EU doesn't have to rely on contribution from member state, it would help change the way that markets see EU bonds. Because for markets, when they think about France or they think about Germany, they think that if they need to repay their debt, they can just tax their citizens or their companies. For the EU, it's much more complicated. They don't have the taxation rights. When they need more money, they need always to ask the countries, and it's much more complicated. So adding this possibility to have like real European taxes would really help change the way that markets and investors perceive EU bonds. And so maybe if we have like this, with an introduction of genuine own resources, maybe it will change the way that EU bonds are priced, because we said that they were priced like the EIB or the ESM. If they are seen like a sovereign, maybe they will switch and they will not be priced versus swap, but maybe they will be priced versus bonds like the Spaniards or like the Portuguese or the French.
If I may kind of be a little bit of a devil advocate here, right? At the end of the day, it's always the taxpayer who has to pay, right? You're saying it's just the procedural issues, where should we go and ask the countries first, or should we just do it ourselves? Ourselves being the European Commission, now taxes. You know, how easy is it going to be to get to that point, to the point where the European Union actually has the ability to raise its own revenues through taxes? Conor, any views?
Probably not very easy, I would say. Progress seems to have stalled. So when this kind of initially was introduced, there was talk of own resources around expanding the ETS, about the CBAM, and then also about the
plastic tax, was that part of it? Yeah.
The plastic levy, but also some revenues from the OECD tax agreements would be apportioned to this own resources cost of financing this. Yeah. However, as we know, like, this is a slow moving area. So agreement was reached on Pillar 2, but, you know, implementation still hasn't yet happened. International tax is a slow moving area. So to be able to get to that point, I think is really important. As Gregory said, it would kind of really, but the key factor that has been seen basically on being treated as a sovereign by market surveys is being included in sovereign bond indices. Mm-hmm. To get to that point, we need some form of some resemblance of a sovereign. Some sort of a taxation revenue would go a long way there. So it's really important.
If I may, I think it's very interesting, the point you're making, because you're saying, like, I mean, unless you also, you know, raise your own taxes, you will always be you pay a price. Yes. So you will, your borrowing cost will always be higher as a result. It's a very interesting point to make.
Yeah, and I think actually market realized that during the year 2022. So I think one of the reasons why this spread increased is that they really believed this Hamiltonian moment was taking place in 2020. The market, when you talk to them, they tell you, yeah, we really believe that this thing would be permanent, that this was the beginning of EU debt forever, etc. But actually, some member states have been repeating quite frequently in 2022 that this was a temporary instrument, that this was a one-off to face once in a century shock, etc. So I think they started doubting also that this was really an Hamiltonian moment. And this might have played an important role in this increase in the spread. So yeah, it's not a sovereign. And it at the beginning, maybe it was even more seen as a sovereign than it is now. Also, the fact that during the energy crisis, for instance, many times there was this idea that was floated around that we should do an NGU-like instrument to solve the energy crisis. And then after, with the introduction of the Inflation Reduction Act in the US, we also discussed, like, oh, we should do an instrument at the European level that would look like NGU, where we could borrow together and do subsidies together. For the moment, none of those ideas have materialized. And I think markets have internalized this. They saw it as permanent. They expected when a new crisis would come, and we faced a new crisis very quickly with the energy crisis. And now with us facing the US IRA, that this did not materialize. And I think that was the part of disappointment from market. And they realized that maybe, yes, this is really not something permanent after all.
It's interesting that we see it in the prices then. It reflects on the... It's a very interesting argument. Well, any last words, Conor, on this issue? I think we are closely coming to an end.
No, I'm just... It's pretty important. Read the paper.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Of course, read the paper. You can find all of it on our webpage, www.bruegel.org. Well, listen, thank you both very much for coming to the Sound of Economics this week and for explaining what is unequivocally a very technical issue, but also for reflecting on the fact that Europe does pay a price for not becoming more integrated in the way that it thinks about solving common problems. I think that is perhaps a very important message to take with us. And no doubt we'll be able to discuss this in future occasions. Thank you for following us today, and we'll see you next time. Thank you both for coming. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Maria.
Thank you.